Before doing so, however, I should demand to know how one man, even with both hands untied, and free to move about, could play upon the violin, guitar, concertina, mouth harmonicon, triangle, and flute, and ring several bells, all at the same moment, how he could imitate the whistling of the wind, the splash of waves, the sucking of a pump, and other sounds, simultaneously with the playing of music of various instruments, how he could see to pick up articles in the dark, to describe things in people's pockets, and reach a particular mouth or cheek to kiss, or a particular hand to shake, for all these things are done in Horatio Eddy's dark circle. And if all these were explained, I should still want to have the episode of Madame Oblavitsky's father's buckle accounted for. I am ready to concede that the medium may slip his hands out of his bonds and go about in his stocking feet in the dark, strumming instruments, pounding tambourines, and touching people. This has been done before, and exposed before. Some, a Boston friend of mine included, even say that they have detected Horatio himself at the game. But that explanation does not cover our case, for it does not show how one man can do the work of a half dozen men, or accomplish such a miracle as that of the buckle brought from the Russian grave. Nor does it show how the discordant fiddle scraping and nasal singing of the mediums can be transformed into the fine execution and artistic coloring of the music of the unseen violinist, flutist, accordionist, and harmonicon player of the dark circles, and the rich soprano and alto voices that sometimes issue from William's cabinet. Therefore, until the desired explanation is vouchsafed by some closer reasoner than I will leave Horatio to prowl about in the dark and play tricks if he will, and hold to my sweet little spirit Mayflower to stand as an ideal of what my own children and other people's children are like, in the other and brighter world to which they have passed on before. To resume, then, on this first night, she said to me, that if I would get her some ribbons, she would make me a wreath, such as she had braided for a lady visitor, and which I had admired. On my way to New York, I procured some ribbons of three colors, in Rutland, and sent them up to Chittenden to the care of a Mr. Luther B. Hunt, of Street Albans, a friend of Horatio, who was visiting at the homestead. The parcel and my note, he says, he put in the pocket of his coat, which hung in his bedroom, intending to take the ribbons with him to the next dark circle, and hold the little maid to the fulfillment of her promise to me. But the same day, William being, as he usually is, under influence, said, Mr. Hunt, if you will go upstairs and look in your pocket you will find something. Mr. Hunt went and searched his coat, but found nothing, and, returning, reported his ill luck. But William said that he had not looked in the right place. It was in the vest pocket where the articles were, and in the vest pocket, sure enough, he found wreaths, one, of which was for me, and the other, for another gentleman. The next evening there was a dark circle, and Mayflower, addressing Mr. Hunt, said that he had overlooked the note for me that she had left with the wreath. Another search of the vest disclosed a tiny note, written on a small square of thin paper, and being to the effect that I was her dear friend, and she thanked me for my kind expressions, and hoped I would keep the wreath to remember her by. So, the least I could do was to have the artist make a sketch of her present, that all the readers may see what sort of braiding they do in the other world in the present year of grace. It struck me a few days afterward that, as Mayflower was in so complacent a mood, she might not be unwilling to give me another specimen of her skill, accompanied with something of a test. So, putting the wreath in my pocket, the next time a dark circle was to be held, I said nothing of my intention to anyone. After the light was extinguished, and the room was so dark that one could not see a hand held close to one's eyes, I took out my wreath and quietly laid it in the lap of the lady sitting beside me. Presently Mayflower's voice said, "Oh, Mrs., what have you got in your lap?" "It's my wreath, Mr. Alcott. You want me to braid it over again for you?" I said I did, in another pattern and with the ribbons passed through some perforated seashells, such as I had heard she had used a long time before for another friend of hers. She replied that she had no shells with her at the moment, but she would get some and rebraid my wreath and return it to me the next time we met. Although no one had known of my purpose, and the wreath had been discovered by Mayflower lying in the lap of a person who did not know what I had placed there in the dark. I thought it better to make assurance doubly sure, so I reached over, and taking the wreath from the lap of the lady on my left, I dropped it on the floor at my right, where no one but myself knew it to be, and no one who could not see in the dark could discover it to pick it up. But when a light was struck soon after, the wreath was gone. It was returned to me on the evening of the 26th of September, under curious circumstances. There was a great power manifested in the dark circle that evening. The Indian dance was given with yells that made some of the timid ones shiver with apprehension, and the dancers stamped on the floor until it seemed as if they must go through into the dining room below. Then George Dix whistled, and played a solo on the fife, and gave us the Storm at Sea, and Mayflower elicited unbounded applause by her accordion and harmonicon, playing with the bell accompaniments, which you may be sure was listened to in profound silence. I have seen no such description of this spirit music as that given by Thackeray's friend, the late Robert Bell, in the Cornhill Magazine for August 1860. He is describing a dark circle of Mr. Holmes, at which an accordion was played. We listened with suspended breath. The air was wild and full of strange transitions, with a wail of pathetic sweetness running through it. The execution was no less remarkable for its delicacy than for its power. When the notes swelled in some of the bold passages, the sound rolled through the room with an astounding reverberation, then, gently subsiding, sank into a strain of divine tenderness. Mayflower's playing is not always alike, sometimes being less sweet and expressive than others, but I have heard it on occasions when the above eloquent description would hardly exaggerate its effect upon the audience. After the concert, George Dix requested Joe Rugg, the faithful farmer of the family, to strike a light and bring a small stand and a glass of water. These directions were complied with, and the water being placed upon the stand, the light was extinguished again, and, for a moment, we were in total darkness. But soon the candle was relighted, and we discovered the glass of water inverted upon the stand, the water within the glass, and nothing over the mouth to keep it in. The light was put out again, and when again called for, the stand was upside down on the floor, and the tumbler, with its contents, right side up, balanced upon the point of one of the legs. The light was extinguished for the fourth time and relighted, and then what should I see but the tumbler on the floor, at my feet, the water all gone, and my wreath, rebraided and decorated with seashells, inside, as dry as a bone. The artist, on page 377, gives us a sketch of their new wreath, and in the series of four small pictures, we have the successive stages of this manifestation depicted. With characteristic irreverence, I suggested that the water had disappeared down the medium's throat, but George Dix told us that it had been dissipated into a fine mist, and was held suspended in the atmosphere of the room. I wish that some of the wiseacres who have accounted for the appearance of child forms in the materializing circles of William Eddy, on the theory that they were pillows, could only have seen a few of them before showing their ignorance so painfully. I wish that my witty fellow lotto's eater, the Honorable Robert B. Roosevelt, had taken the trouble to visit Chittenden, before putting himself on record as such a hasty generalizer upon the spiritualistic phenomena, as he does in a recently published letter to the Daily Graphic. Hear him talk about William Eddy and these baby spirits. No one feels like laughter at the sight of the devoted wife hungering to find in the fantastic figure, donned in dim twilight by some sham medium, the beloved shape of her dead husband, or in the agonized mother longing to recognize, in the painted knees of a charlatan, exhibited in the same darkness, the rosy cheeks of her darling, gone from her forever. We cannot laugh at these exhibitions of wifely or maternal love, but we should scorn and denounce the impostors who make a living by playing on these noblest affections of human nature. Painted knees, quotha. William Eddy's painted knees. Why, can a man's knees walk detached, and say papa and mama, and I am happy, and throw kisses to us, and courtesy, and all that sort of thing? Could they, even if they were painted dunducky and mud color, edged with sky blue scarlet? Can a man of 179 pounds, and 5 feet 9 inches, dressed to represent a young girl with bare neck and arms, a weight of 120 pounds, and a height of, say, 5 feet 1 inch, walk up and down the stage, fondling his own knee as if it were a baby, and making it stick simulated thumbs into an imaginary mouth, and pass false chubby arms around his neck, and move them about? We had one dose, recently, from a pseudo-investigator, in a puerile explanation of phenomena he never saw, by the application of a theory that wouldn't even fit the few things he did see. Let us be spared repetition. If certain men of prominent social, political, or professional standing are asked what they think about materialization, why cannot they be honest enough to say they know nothing about it, and not put themselves up for the ridicule of those who do? The discovery of apparently so gross a fraud as the more recent of the Katie King materializations, in Philadelphia, in the presence of the Holmes mediums, even if real, does not invalidate one single genuine phenomenon of this class. Foolish editors, anxious to disbelieve the possibility of the reappearance of the dead in materialized form, may indulge in exhibitions of premature hilarity, may announce the exposure of this latest and the most dangerous humbug, and vote the spiritualistic delusion finally and effectually disposed of, but their ignorance and prejudice plead in their behalf for lenity of judgment. We had just such behavior from them in 1847, when self-sufficient wise men explained away the Rochester wrappings upon the kneecap and toe joint theory. There is no occasion to doubt that this recent jubilation will result in the same confusion of face to these expounders as did the other, and as 50 of the same kind have, since that time. The phenomena of modern spiritualism have agitated society for more than a quarter of a century, and the interest in the subject is tenfold greater today than ever before, by the confession of its bitterest opponents. It is not doubted by the best informed investigators, that the very persons whose trickery is claimed to have been shown up, are powerful mediums. Someday we will see a new principle of investigation adopted, and mediums will be judged as such, apart from their merits or demerits as individuals. Then, skeptics and believers, alike, will neither be, on the one hand elated nor on the other depressed by the discovery that all mediums are more or less given to the imitation of the genuine phenomena which occur, under favorable conditions, in their presence. Occupying, as I do, a neutral position between the two classes, I am both surprised and amused to see how they are affected respectively, by each new revelation like the one to which I have referred above. No one should undertake the difficult work of investigating this or any other branch of knowledge, unless he is able to view the whole ground, note every detail whether favorable or unfavorable, and pursue his labors with the passionless calm of science. The above paragraphs had hardly been written, when the post brought me a letter from a respected and perfectly trustworthy correspondent which serves as a commentary upon my remarks concerning the probable mediumship of the Holmes. Says the writer, I have seen, as yet, no satisfactory explanation of the phenomena which I witnessed at the Holmes seances last summer. H. S. Oh, until I do, I shall not, simply because I cannot, believe them to have been trickery. Why do they not tell us who the John King was, whom we saw standing by Katie's side, while the medium sat with Mr. Rowan and myself, holding our hands? The levitation of the form of Katie, which I saw, was not simulated by getting upon a black stool. I saw distinctly the lower limbs, and white, bare feet, moving in the air, as if the form were partially reclining. Nor do I in the least believe that the apparent dissolving of the form was produced by black cloths. I saw too much that is not yet accounted for, to make me yield up my confidence in its genuineness. At this present, the Holmeses are protesting their veritable mediumship. It is a pity that some unbiased person could not investigate the case under proper test conditions. It seems the more necessary, since in addition to all other sources of confusion, cards of a very contradictory nature, as to the reality of the Holmes phenomena, from Dr. H. T. Child, of Philadelphia, and Gen. F. J. Lippitt, of Boston, have just appeared in the Banner of Light. The latter gentleman is the author of an article in the December Galaxy entitled Was It Katie King? in which he describes a number of phenomena which appear impossible of simulation. Among these may be mentioned the fact that, after the face of the supposed materialized Katie King had been exposed rather longer than usual, the eyes began to sag, and appear as if melting, but upon the spirit's withdrawing into the cabinet for a minute or so, she would reappear, smiling, and with her features perfectly natural again. Because a man has seen some tables turn, or heard a few raps, or caught Foster, or Home, or the Davenports, or even one of the Eds, sometimes playing tricks when conditions were unfavorable for genuine manifestations of the occult force, why should he rush pell-mell into the ditch of sweeping conjecture, and besmear such reputation as he may have for impartiality, acumen, and thoroughness? 50 or 50,000 cases of mediumistic trickery do not invalidate a solitary genuine fact. Dear old John Broom has turned the hose of his inspired wrath upon the fire of investigation that reddens the whole intellectual horizon, and he hopes to put it out by declaring that, as for the last new, childishly ridiculous phase of the prevailing insanity, materialization, it is so gross and manifest a cheat, that one's common sense revolts at the villainous compound of impudence and profanity. To discuss it seriously would be a waste of words. I see the dear old fellow now, at whist in the Lotto's club, sipping his brandy and soda, and uttering, or rotundo, this grandiloquent diatribe. But it will not avail. People of pluck and intelligence are not to be diverted from their hunt after the truth, by either ridicule or invective. This is the tune of a death struggle between religion and materialism. The gladiators are fighting for all they hold dear in the way of opinion. They waste no words, but grip each other, and look into each other's eyes, each watching and waiting for the chance to hurl the other into the deep abyss of oblivion. It is too late to try to stop this issue. It is here. We are in its midst, and that is why people will hear all that can be said of these eddy materializations, and of all the minor phases of this wonderful manifestation from the other world to this. Now, if either of my esteemed friends, previously mentioned, had been at Chittenden on the evening of October 1, what would he have seen? Through the dim twilight of the circle room he would have seen upon the platform the figure of a woman with a child in her arms. He would have seen this woman in white, step forward to the railing, and stand there, stroking the baby's head, looking towards a lady in the audience, and waiting to be addressed. He would have seen the baby move its head as a living child does, and the woman pat it, and apparently smooth its soft hair as a mortal woman would a mortal child's, to keep it quiet. He would have seen a group so real that all preconceptions about painted knees or painted anything else would have left his mind at once, and he would have sat there, as we did, wondering whence these forms had come and how long they would tarry. And then, as the lady spectator caught the resemblance of the figure to her dead sister, he would have heard a wail break from that mother's heart, and her imploring cry to be allowed to go up and embrace the darling whom she had last seen in its coffin, and had despaired of ever seeing again. If his eyes were not by this time moistened with the tears of human sympathy, as John Broom's certainly would have been, he would then have seen this spirit woman on the platform kiss the babe in her arms and fondle it, and hold it out over the railing towards its mother, to give assurance that it was in good hands, and rejoice her heart with at least the sight of her child, if she might not take it to her bosom and cover it with kisses. Heavens! Could a man of refined feeling witness such a scene as this, not an uncommon one at the Eds, and not rejoice with the mother over the finding of the lost one, and grieve with her when, in another moment, it passed away from her sight into that world of shadows that lies as a borderland between us and eternity? Such value as these observations of mine at Chittenden may have, is largely due to the fact that they are corroborative of the experiments of Mr. Crookes, under strictly test conditions. While his results do not strengthen mine, since the circumstances surrounding us both were entirely different, and inferior in my case to his, yet mine do his, for I have, in all human probability, witnessed 300 or 400 appearances of spirit forms, similar to his Katie King, in the solidity of their bodies, their physical movements, the manner of their appearance and disappearance, and their use of speech and display of mental action. If in any one instance I could have seen Honto disappear under test conditions, or, when she was outside the cabinet, have been allowed to see William Eddy inside, or if, after lining the cabinet sides, ceiling, and floor with some impenetrable fabric, and shutting William in such a way that he could not possibly have walked out without my knowing it, spirits had presented themselves to my view, then the whole of the other 300-and-odd apparitions would have counted on the credit side of my balance sheet, with the Eddy mediums. In my own mind, I am satisfied that no fraud was perpetrated by William, but that is not conviction, based upon the firm rock of mathematical demonstration. It is a sentiment, not an axiom. And yet, I do not know that I can blame these boys for acting as they did towards me. I must not judge them by an arbitrary standard, such as I would apply to my own case. I can put myself in the place of the Eddy family, and see that if a stranger whose habits, thoughts, and ways were utterly unlike and antipodal to mine, were to come, unasked, and plant himself as a sort of sentinel to watch my every movement, study my very thoughts, scrutinize my slightest action, and force me to see him on the alert, by day and night, for a long succession of weeks, I should feel like putting him out of the window, if he would not use the door the carpenter made. I don't think that the plea that it was all for the good of the public, and in the interest of science, would make it any pleasanter to reflect that he regarded me as a liar and cheat, until I had proved to his satisfaction that I was not. This, if I were ever so honest, while, if I were only a little and semi-occasionally disposed to help things along when they lagged, or if the person were bent upon digging into the roots of things, to discover principles and laws of which I knew little and cared less, I should wish him to remove, with bag and baggage, and not vex me or my spirit band with isms and ologies, when we were only bent on producing certain physical phenomena for the consolation of the average spiritualist. Chapter 25, The Shakers as Spiritualists. There appeared in the New York Daily Graphic, of date November 24, 1874, a lively and interesting report of an interview between one of the editors and Frederick W. Evans, one of the chief elders of the Society of Shakers, at which time strange assertions were made. Among other things, Mr. Evans said that 11 years before the rappings through the mediumship of the Fox Girls, similar and much more striking phenomena had run their course throughout the peaceful settlements of this devoted people. The children were first seized with trances, or clairvoyant sleeps, in which they would answer questions correctly, and display the power of seeing objects and persons without the use of the corporeal eye. The affair got bruited about among the brethren and sisters, and the spirits first manifesting themselves in the Lebanon settlement, passed on to Wat of Liat, and so, in turn, to all the 60 communities of the order. The Shakers took the communications at first, much as the world's people do now, believing the stories told by the invisible beings, and keeping a record, which was afterwards published in sundry books, the titles of two of which were Holy Wisdom and The Sacred Roll. Mr. Evans claims to have first defined, in 1860, spiritualism as a science and not a religion. He says that it should be studied in the same manner as agriculture, chemistry, or any other of the physical sciences. He declared that it ran through three phases in his society, and the report continues thus: what are those? The first is the test phase. In this, the seeker is principally interested in ascertaining the reality of the communications and their genuineness. We wish to test the mediums, and inquire whether the manifestations are really what they pretend to be. What is the second phase? The second phase is the judgment phase. In this, social relations are established between those in and those out of the flesh. Attachments were formed between the spirit world and the mediums, and the attachments began to take the form of criticisms. The spirits instructed and reproved. The second phase was a phase of judgment on the individual and on society. During the whole of this phase, we were forming a relation with the higher spirits, and they were instructing and criticizing us. Then it was that spiritualism began to be a ministration of religion. That was what caused our people to interblend religion and spiritualism. We attached an infallibility to the manifestations, similar to the infallibility which the Christian world attaches to the scriptures. The second phase was a phase of judgment, for purging out everything that was wrong in the character of the individual, correcting faults, reproving error, and amending the life and disposition. What do you call the third phase? The missionary phase. When the second phase was finished, and the revelations had been received from the highest spirits, then we preached the truth to the lower spirits. We were missionaries to the other world. Religion was ministered to us by the higher circles of spirits, and we ministered to those who were below us. Then it was that the work of judgment took effect among those spirits, and they would confess their faults and the sins of their lives, just as though they were in this life. I have heard many spirits confess their sins. 393. You are a medium, then? Yea. All the Shakers are mediums. There is scarcely an exception. These confessions are made to the mediums, and then they would repeat it aloud. The spirits would obsess an individual, and then the confessions would be made. Do you have any of these manifestations now? Yea. We can have as much of them as we like. The spirits of the prophets are subject to the prophets. What kind of confessions were made by the spirits? Some of the most interesting confessions were made by members of a tribe of Indians. These came and confessed their sins to us, and said they would join our order. Then we would appoint them elders and eldresses, and then they would go off to their tribe and preach to them, and the spirits of the tribe would confess to them and they would become Shakers. When they had done this they would come again to us, just the same as if they were in the body. For instance, one or two elders might be in the room below, and there would be a knock at the door, and the Indians would ask whether they might come in. Permission being given, a whole tribe of Indian spirits would troop into the house, and in a few minutes you would hear whoop here and whoop there, all over the house. But nobody in the rooms above had known that the elders had admitted the Indian spirits. Nay. We only knew it who heard them ask permission to enter. But in a few minutes after permission was given, everybody in the house would be obsessed. You would hear the men and women talking as if they were Indians. No theatricals that ever you saw on earth were equal to it. They would act out what they were simulating. They would sing new songs entirely unknown to our people, and sometimes they would sing in a foreign language that none of us knew. The mediums would converse together as if they were Indians, and not as themselves. You never let the outside world know what was going on? Nay, indeed. What took place among us was so wonderful that it seemed incredible. And if we had published it to the world, we should all have been sent to Bedlam. Don't you think that modern spiritualism is much the same thing as the visions of monks and nuns in the Middle Ages? Certainly. That is the proper explanation of them through all the ages. The visions of St. Teresa were merely spiritualistic visions, just such as we have frequently had vouchsafed to the members of our society. And necromancy and magic belong to the same category? Yea. That is, when spiritualism is used for selfish ends, and probably mixed with fraud and pretense, like Dr. Kraft. If you editors of papers were to turn your criticism upon Dr. Kraft, with its abominable frauds and shams, and pretenses, and poisonous drugs, you would be doing a real service to mankind. Well, reverting to your spiritual experiences, how is it that you never published them to the world? We have always known that we should have a work to do in relation to spiritualism, but we did not know when that work would begin. The manifestations lasted 7 years, then they ceased. The spirits told us when they left us, that in a very short time they would give manifestations everywhere, from the palace to the hamlet, all over the world. We knew that we should have to work at the appointed time, but we knew also, that Providence would point out to us the way and the method in which we should work. It was 4 years, before we had any evidence of the truth of what the spirits had told us. Many of us had begun to doubt, we thought that they had deceived us. But when the Rochester manifestations began, then all knew that they had told us the truth. So I and another member of the society went off to Rochester to question the spirits. I asked them if this was the work for which we had so long been waiting. They told us yes. Immediately that we entered the room, the wrappings were made on the table and all around us in the most remarkable manner. The spirits manifested great joy at our arrival. I saw that the room was full of spirits. Margaret and Catherine Fox left everybody to come and assist us in our conversations with the spirits. We sat down and held long conversations with them. We asked them if the work for which we had been so long waiting had really commenced. They said yes, it had. I then asked them if they would show themselves in materializations. I asked them if they would act in the same way upon material elements, as they had acted upon spiritual elements. They said, yes. Then you consider that the recent materializations are genuine? Yea, certainly. I visited the Eds at their homestead, and I am certain their manifestations are genuine. I was up there about 3 weeks ago. Colonel Olcott is doing a good work there, and I will say that he is correct so far as I was a witness of what occurred. How many Shakers visited the Eds? Myself and John Greaves. How long were you there? 3 nights. How many different apparitions did you see? Between 20 and 30 men and women.